Hey all, welcome to Book Spider. We talk about books, movies, music, and sometimes big things like politics, philosophy, and the evolution of art. My name is Chris, and I'm joined by my co-hosts, Hans and Patrick. Today we're talking about Mad God, a stop-motion film 30 years in the making. Its creator, Phil Tippett, is a legendary VFX artist and animator. When I say legendary, I mean Star Wars, Indiana Jones, RoboCop, Jurassic Park, and more. But any two of those that I listed would make him legendary, and he has four. So I guess that makes him maybe the legend. The movie is almost entirely stop motion, mixed with a few real human actors. Its texture is Hieronymus Bosch crossed with H.R. Giger and Lynch. I divide it into roughly three parts. In part one, we follow a nameless figure wearing a kind of dystopian World War I punk rubber suit with a gas mask obscuring his face as he descends through layers of a gruesome hell world. At his destination, he arms and sets a timer for a bomb, but is captured before the bomb can explode. The emissary from above is then dissected while alive. A wriggling maggot that screams in the voice of a human baby is extracted from his abdomen, and a camera of some sort is inserted into his skull. The footage from the inside of the emissary's skull is what I consider to be part two. In part two, we see a kind of priest lord in some kind of frozen castle or bunker, surrounded by ululating and buttfucking emissaries, mutants, and seemingly undead. We watch as he lowers another emissary into another hell world via the bathysphere. Then we follow as Emissary 2 navigates this second world, blasted to dust by endless war, on his way to a deep pit that we see him descend with his own briefcase bomb. Part 3 follows the maggot baby from the first emissary's abdomen as it's carried by a floating plague doctor thing deep into what I take to be its castle or stronghold or whatever. And I wonder if maybe the plague doctor thing is the master of the world that we tour in part 1. Maybe all of the factory parts that we see there, fueled by the shit of giants, routed down through the tubes and slurped up by a huge head in rictus, then molded into hairball slaves that make the obelisks that surround the plague doctor's castle thing. Maybe they're all his. That's speculation on my part. But in any case, the plague doctor thing and what I take to be his assistant smash the maggot baby into goo and use the goo, refined sort of powder from the goo, to create a whole new world. Then we watch in rapid montage as this newly created world progresses technologically and then destroys itself, becoming yet another hell world. Then all of the bombs of all of the emissaries trigger, but instead of an explosion, we jump cut to a cuckoo bursting out of its clock and singing at our face. So, what scene sticks out for you guys and why?
So many of them. But for me, I guess I'll just mention the first one that pops in my mind. So, as the first emissary, as you called it, the Wikipedia entry called them assassins, but
yeah, I think Tippett calls them the assassins, but I actually don't. I feel like I don't like that term.
Well, emissary is good either way, but the first emissary is kind of he's just set down, and he's like spying some weird house on the hill. with his binoculars, and he sees in one of the windows, and there's like a man stabbing a woman in the chest, but like sounds of female sexual arousal are locked in time with the downstroke of the stabbing, so that like the woman seems to enjoy it or whatever. But then, like, some weird mummy creature throws out a light bulb, and to catch a little goblin or monster or whatever, almost like he's fishing for food, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then, so the mummy creature pulls the fish goblin into his little pipe, I assume to eat. And then out of that house up on the hill that the emissary has spied with his glasses comes this like giant goblin creature with a butcher knife, and it comes down and it looks in the pipe and it takes out the mummy creature and cuts up the mummy creature with its butcher knife. And that was like the first image of a concept that seemed to repeat over and over again, and that's of like a one creature preying upon another only to be destroyed in turn. Yeah, so that seemed like a motif. So it seemed it's repeated later in the alchemists or the plague doctor's assistant's little mushroom world. He puts mealworms in the mushroom world, and a little mushroom, sentient mushroom creature eats one of the mealworms, but then a fucked up spider comes in and eats the mushroom creature that just ate the mealworm.
While the alchemist assistant is laughing.
Yeah, while the alchemist slash assistant guy is laughing. So that seemed like a pretty big idea, and so that those kind of scenes stuck out to me.
I listened to a couple podcasts and read a few articles about this for background, and a couple of things that I heard, a couple of people whose opinions I heard, were the one weak link they pointed to in the movie was the occasional presence of human actors, that certain characters were just rendered by human performance because they felt like it was kind of a flaw in the unity of it, you know?
Mm.
Mm.
Which wouldn't really have occurred to me as a critique, actually, right? Like, part of the appeal of something like this is the ways that a bunch of different, like, means of creating an image come together, right?
Mm-hmm.
Human performance being just kind of like one relatively minor but key technique in that palette, right? And when you asked about scenes that stuck out, I think one thing that really I remember being really just kind of having a quality that stuck with me is the human performance. There's kind of a nurse character who brings the baby to the plague doctor. And clearly, you know, feels ambivalence and reluctance about handing it over, but does so and then kind of goes to this horrid little shabby bedroom-ish place and is, you know, lying there experiencing guilt. And that, I think, was interesting to me because, you know, there's not this movie has a really interesting quality where there is, in some ways, like it creates a whole universe. It's about creating a universe, right? But also there's, in some ways, relatively little conventional world building. And the question of who lives here and what lives here and how much of the human and the compassionate exists in this world is very left up in the air, right? But you have this kind of little moment of what we might think of as conventional sympathy and humanity that sticks out in a very interesting way. And for the ways in which it is both kind of emotionally different from a lot of the tone of the rest of it, but also rendered by an actor, which is also very distinct. And the mix of particularly like that figure standing in front of the plague doctor, who is one of the most interesting effects in the whole film, right? With the way that they use different filming speeds to kind of make him float in slow motion. That scene, just as an example of the ways that this is like not just a movie about here's a whole bunch of cool stop motion, right? But a movie about here are a lot of different kind of ways of creating visual information kind of all woven together. That sequence, I think, was really very virtuosic in that regard, and also kind of had an emotional depth to it that was very distinct.
I'm really glad you brought up that. I hadn't thought about the way in which this is. It definitely can be read as sort of stitched together, like in Tippett's, you know, the margins of Tippett's time. You know, like he's doing this over the course of, you know, many years, while still contributing to the mainline film industry. And, you know, I think I've seen it four times now, and I think I could with pretty strong confidence, like disentangle things that look a little bit different. Maybe because, you know, certain things were shot 30 years before certain other things. And so I can see how you could take that and then, you know, jump to a criticism about the different techniques that have, you know, there's a couple shots in the bathysphere right away where, like, sometimes it's a stop motion figure in the bathysphere and sometimes it's a human person wearing a costume. And I didn't really pick up on that. And that's definitely, you know, maybe that's just was necessary to get it across. But I think to get that scene done rather. But I think that you're right. I think that there's intentional integration of a bunch of different effects, tricks, and styles and modalities, and that has a certain effect. And I don't know what it is, but it definitely feels intentional. Like the nurse and the surgeon when they first appear is like this sort of shadow play thing that feels extremely jarring, you know, when you're first watching it, because it's suddenly a very different looking movie. It feels like it's drawing on a very, very, very aware of what it's doing when it's doing that. So I think that, yeah, you can take the time to pick apart where things are sort of stitched together, and, or I think you can really value, what it's trying to do.
I think with something like this, you want the seams to show in a way, right? Like conventionally with film, with special effects and filmmaking, the theoretical goal is to find something that looks as much as possible like you just found that thing in the world and pointed the camera at it, right? You watch, yeah, you know, Jurassic Park, and the goal is to think, oh, this is no different from if they went to a park full of dinosaurs and pointed a camera at it, right? But like, with something like this, as technology has evolved, the whole the benefit of stop motion is the artificiality of it, paradoxically, right? This thing that used to be used as kind of a uncanny simulation of reality, the point of the movie, in a way, is to turn that completely into a freestanding art form, because advances in technology have liberated that from the need to be a simulation of reality. And things that make the seams, a certain amount of seam showing, I think is partly, I suppose, thematic, right? Because like it's a movie about creation to some extent. And so the act of creation being on display in the movie is kind of, in a way, recapitulated by the alchemist creating a universe at the end, creating and destroying it. But then also it just makes itself, I don't know, it displays itself in a way, right? And if it were just 100% stop motion models front to back without those other styles and techniques mixing in kind of a maybe even a little bit of an awkward way, it would have the paradoxical effect of kind of undermining itself, I think.
Yeah, I think you see the hand of the creator, right?
And that's a great way to put it.
That's so distinct now when movies, you know, sort of big complex, and it's, you know, this isn't like a criticism, but like movies are made by teams of people, so it's really hard to see like a person. Like maybe you see the director in some of the choices that they make in how to portray things. It depends on how distinctive the director is. But when you're talking about the actual sort of construction of a world and of the things in that world and the, you know, the texture, the visual texture of the thing that we're looking at, you know, it is meant to just be as, you know, seamless as possible. You know, James Cameron doesn't want us to like see zippers in the back of the, I don't know, the Navi, right? They're called the Navi. You know, that's not, that would be really antithetical to the goal. But I think here we see, and I see at this point in time, having watched it so many times, I see little choices, 1,000 little choices every second of this movie. Not 1,000 every second, but you know what I mean. It's every single shot is full of choices that I can see and feel like I can, you know, I don't know, appreciate. And I'll jump to this question that I had at the end of my list, or one of the at the end of the list. But the first thing that struck me when I saw this movie is just the amount of expertise and work and time that would have to go into something like this, and reportedly did. And Phil Tippett had a nervous breakdown near the end that he attributes to his work on this. And, you know, the amount of work that went into this and the amount of work that is, you know, actually contributed by a renowned master of his craft, a craft that is totally by hand. And it just feels really important to appreciate something like this in our time. You know, now we're on the precipice of a time when it is, I don't know what the draw will be for people to do stuff with their hands, at least, you know, in film, because of visual effects and AI and all of that. And so I feel like I'm never going to see anything like this ever again in my life. And it fills me with sadness. Can you reassure me and tell me that I shouldn't be worried
you should be worried.
Yeah. There's not more of these coming, we don't think.
No, I don't think so. I mean, I think that, well, it's just the nature of human mortality. Like, you know, so I don't know if you guys noticed this, but as in one of the earliest scenes, as the diving bell is descending, it goes into this cavern with all these figurines and things. You remember the figurines, mm-hmm, and sculptures? One of them is a recreation of the Cyclops from the film Sinbad. Sinbad movies that Ray Harryhausen did. And I saw it right away because I watched those. I watched a bunch of Harryhausen movies when I was a kid, and I loved them. Like the Sinbad movie, Clash, mm-hmm, of the Titans, other stuff. I just loved those like claymation figures that, you know, granted they didn't look real, but they looked fucking cool. I thought it was cool. I thought it was cool to see like Perseus fighting giant scorpions that, you know, didn't matter that they didn't look real because they were monsters. But anyway, so like, you know, that scene, it's doing a bunch of things, but he's like, Tippett's giving a little nod to like Harryhausen, like, hey, this is, I like the one of the original guys, Harryhausen, for this kind of effect. And like, there's just, you know, after Tippett, there's not really anyone else because of, like you said, there's no, there's no need for the technology anymore. So I assume that the art form is going to die out the way art forms do die out, right? And maybe I'm wrong in that you'll never see another movie that's stop motion animation, but eventually there won't be any new ones, and then this could be the last like one that's really trying to use it as a distinct art form, which is sad.
I can see an argument either way, right? You know, on the one hand, I mean, I guess if you're a techno-optimist, if you're a radical techno-optimist, which I certainly am very, very far from, but just to, like, you know, give the argument a space.
Sure.
If you're a radical techno-optimist, you would say that at some point in the relatively near future, human labor is going to be less required for many jobs and people are going to have a lot more free time, right? And maybe there is a period when that causes great upheaval, but at some point we settle into a new economic equilibrium where people just have a lot more space to pursue things that they find intrinsically rewarding rather than to work for material benefit, right? And we're going to have to reorient society and economics and philosophy and our motivations around that. But if that world were to exist, it would create a space to do things things for the sake of the process of doing them rather than for some, you know, end result, often with an economic impact, right? And the, you know, you have a world in which people have the space to do something like rediscover, recreate the art of stop motion animation, right? And I don't know that, I mean, I don't think this will ever be done again because this is so individual, right? This will never be done again in the same way that any great artist, when they're gone, there will be no more work like them, right? But I mean, I don't know, like painting, photorealistic painting has been theoretically unnecessary since the advent of the camera, right? Less and less so every day, but there are still people who make photorealistic paintings. That art has, there are certainly like versions of that are no longer practiced because the artists are dead, but the art of incredibly realistic painting has not vanished from the world, even though it's technologically redundant, theoretically, right? Now, I think the counter argument makes itself so easily that I don't even need to say it, right? Like, this is a boutique thing that is economically irrelevant and the world is going to be full of new toys and nobody's going to bother. And that, I mean, that's probably what'll happen, you know? But I don't know that that's a absolutely foregone conclusion. I just
wanted to add, like, it's on your topic, Hans, but maybe slightly off topic for the podcast. But David Graeber wrote the Anarcha. He died back in 2020 or 21. I forget. He caught COVID and it resulted in like pancreatitis, and he died just like that, unfortunately. But anarchist anthropologist David Graeber wrote a pretty cool book called Bullshit Jobs. And one thing that he points out in Bullshit Jobs is that the technology to reduce our workday or our work week to like 20 or 15 hours already exists. You know, automated food production, automated production of all kinds exists, and but instead of stopping working because of the way capitalism functions, bullshit jobs have proliferated, where people just like they just have jobs that are totally meaningless and utterly stupid, but it still upholds like the capitalist economic system. So I would just say that if if something like this is going to survive in a society that like switches to a new mode, it's probably not going to be because of the technology itself. So that's just like a thing to add.
Sure.
And we can move on.
Yeah. And I mean, clearly I was, you know, steel manning a case I don't really think that I believe in much as I would like
right,
to.
Right, right. Sure. Sure.
It is very strange to me. It is very strange to me to think that knowledge, ways of doing things, that knowledge could just slip from the world like that, you know? That, like,
it's scary.
That we couldn't in some way rediscover how to do stop motion, right? Like it I don't know. It's funny. I think about this with my job because the state agency that I work for has a mainframe computer system, right? Like the computer architecture and the way that we interface with it to like do our important state work literally has not changed meaningfully since maybe 1988, right? And we've reached a point where we've been kind of meaning to replace it and meaning to replace it and never quite getting around to it for decades, literally. And we've kind of reached this crisis point where like programmers who can work on it are there, like all the programmers who ever knew how to work on and maintain the system are retiring. And it's so strange to me that that could happen, right? Like it's a fucking computer system. We built it. We can figure out how to maintain it, right? But it seems as though it is actually, I don't know, like it may, and maybe it's not that the knowledge completely evaporates, but it just is not spread to a level where it's feasible to like have access to the very small number of people who still know how to do it. And maybe there's an equivalent with stop motion. I don't know, but
this medium feels like something that you are apprenticed in, that or that you fall in love with and go and put yourself next to someone who does it, and you learn, you know, through this, you know, exposure and not necessarily through like recipes or curricula or anything like that. This isn't, you know, this isn't a domain that, you know, cooks down to quantifiable skills. It's something that you learned hands-on. It is a physical medium. And it just feels like, you know, I don't know if our brains operate differently. You know, that was my initial thought. But certainly our system for educating people and passing down skills and knowledge is, I think, almost like a different language from the language that teaches skills like this. And so it does feel to me like, you know, not forever, whatever, nothing's forever, but it does feel like we're passing into a time where there will be less. And I don't, this question wasn't specifically about stop motion, but I didn't really make that clear. It's more that this is one of the rare modern, in that it came out very recently, visual things where I felt so close to an extremely personal expression, right? Like in the moment with the creator while he's creating this. And I just don't think that anything like that, I'm never going to see visual art, visual cinema art. I could just say cinema art. Any movie with anything like anything approaching that, released maybe in my lifetime. I just, that makes me sad.
It makes me think a little bit about, I think I can see this effect, but I'm not totally sure where I see it. I'm going to say maybe Gumby, something like Gumby, like low budget claymation. If you think about low budget claymation, like a Gumby episode, often you can see the fingerprint of the person who,
yes,
literally the fingerprint for just a frame, right? It's like certain shots in Gumby, there's this kind of like continually flickering sort of dance of thumbprints from the, you know, physical hand of the person who moved the little figurine. And I just think that's delightful, right? I love that. I don't think that effect literally appears in Mad God, but it's kind of like that same idea, you know, blown up to its greatest possible scale. And I don't know. I mean, I guess some version of that, if it is good in a way that is inherently soothing and stimulating to the self to do, right? If it's therapeutic to create in that manner, surely it must endure to some extent, right? I mean, really very little of creative work is economically necessary or done in a least path of least resistance sort of manner.
That reassures me. And I'll jump back into talking about the actual content of the film, and you saying it that way makes me sort of want to frame this question a little bit differently, because I think, you know, we were talking about ways of seeing this film, and I think one way of seeing it is like a shifting, like, and inconstant sort of collage of different things that Tippett found cathartic to make, and I'm not putting that word in his mouth. He described the process of making this film as very cathartic, and so, you know, you could say that it's less something to be understood and more something to be experienced. But I am going to ask, like, if you guys have your own take on this process that we're seeing in the film. Whereby emissaries are sent from above by a weird priest lord with long fingernails down into a totally, totally fucking smote hellscapes with the goal of blowing them up. But at least one of these worlds, people are capturing these emissaries and using the maggot babies harvested from their abdomens to jumpstart whole new worlds that themselves become totally fucked up at some point. Like, what is this process that we're seeing? Because it does feel like it's a process. There's a kind of like a machine, a cycle, you know, there's many emissaries, there's potentially many worlds, or at least I read them as different worlds. And it feels like there's many briefcases with many bombs. So this keeps happening. And I wonder if we're meant to interpret anything from that, or if you guys have any interpretations that you took away yourselves.
I don't know if I have a great theory to offer. I mean, I mentioned a little bit earlier the idea of it being like, this is the act of making this movie, in a way, is the act of creating and destroying a little universe, right? So it makes sense that there would be a little universe created and destroyed within the film. It's like the content is recapitulating the process. And there's a unity to that that I find satisfying. But I don't know if I can kind of construct a coherent cosmology of it necessarily. I mean, what you said, Chris, I don't know if I can add to that in any kind of cohesive way beyond just sort of pointing to it as a meta narrative about the making of the thing, and maybe in some sense about all artistic creation, I suppose. Because, you know, it seems, I don't know this for sure, but I get the sense that presumably most of the figures that were made for this were probably destroyed ultimately in the process of making it, right? If only because most of the characters themselves are kind of destroyed. There aren't a whole bunch of pristine props sitting around in a warehouse. And so the fact that the universe dies actually connects more closely to that than you might think.
That's super interesting. I did not take this to be a meditation on artistic creation at all. But I definitely see what you're saying, and it makes sense to me that my reaction would kind of come from my own belief system, whereas you, Hans, are more interested in art that comments on art. So that makes sense to me that you would kind of see this as art commenting on itself. Whereas, you know, I just assumed that this was about the hellscape that is existence that continues on and on and on and on eternally forever, where the strong destroy the weak and the weak suffer. And yeah, it's a hellscape. And so I assumed it was just a very pessimistic take on existence.
And if you're saying it's attached to existence, are you also saying that there are things in the movie that connect to real things? And like, are there, is it just as a whole, a kind of like metaphor for like what it is to be alive? Or are you saying, suggesting that there are direct symbolic connections between some of the things in the movie? And
I didn't necessarily think that there were allegorical connections, like this means that. I guess I was thinking more like the symbology of you know, the strong eat the weak, and
the hairball slaves
are stomped on by the shit testicle eye monsters. And you know, there's a god up in the sky who sees his creation and thinks it's horrendous and sends an assassin down to destroy it, but of course he fails because he's an insane evil god that has very little power. Maybe not evil, but an insane stupid god that you know caused this whole muck in the first place and can't do anything about it. And you know, this happens eternally forever and ever on infinite different worlds, and the seed of life that the creator sends down is never, unfortunately, snuffed out entirely and is used to create other worlds and other existences that can only bring pain and suffering. And yeah, it's a pessimistic tract is the way I took it. It's like reading one of those pessimistic philosophy works of pessimist philosophy that I like, you know, like Schopenhauer or Benatar or something.
That may even be the spirit with which it was created, but I actually, you know, I've said this before on the podcast, but like I tend to have a hard time with like extremely dark stuff, like,
sure.
And I have a sort of visceral philosophical rejection to some of the more nihilist work that's out there, like Lars von Trier. Like, I deeply admire his movies, like Melancholia, Antichrist.
I think the only one of his I saw was the Sex Doll one with Ryan Gosling, which didn't seem super nihilist to me. But
I haven't seen that one, but I know about it, its existence. But like, you know, I tend to just not like that
sure.
Worldview. But somehow I only got through Mad God the first time because I was so astounded that something like this existed. Like, right. I was just gobsmacked by like what I was looking at. And then the second time, I started to, I just basically every time I've watched it, this isn't a profound statement, I've just become more at ease with everything that's happening to the extent now. And the music in this movie is very,
I like the music.
I loved it.
Yeah, I thought it was neat.
It's very chill, actually.
Yeah. And that was a cool contrast.
Yeah. And actually, watching it, I feel very chill, very zen at this point. Like, I really only kind of look forward to the scenes. And I don't know if I have enough distance from that to explain it or explore it, or maybe it's not actually that notable, but it actually, there's something in the movie that I haven't been able to name, and I've really tried, so maybe I'm just fucking crazy, is I really think that there's something positive, but I don't know. I can't defend that. What did you guys think about the movie as on the whole? Like, we've talked about different takes on different aspects of it, and you know, kind of what it might mean, what it meant to us. But just how did you appreciate it or not?
I thought it was great. I thought it was fantastic, wonderful, great experience. I was actually like almost on the edge of my seat, enthralled by like what would happen. You know, like there was a tension in the movie that I really appreciated and really enjoyed, where like you can tell the emissary is trying to accomplish something, but you don't know what, and like you're happy to like experience this hell world as he sees it, as he is descending to accomplish what he's trying to accomplish. And then he gets captured and you're like, oh fuck. That, I mean, am I sad? Like, I don't, like, is this even a character? He gets captured and he gets dissected, but then the tension happens again, because you know, there's a new emissary going down onto this other world to try to accomplish something, and the plague doctor is going somewhere to try to accomplish something else. And so this whole time I was really interested in seeing how everything would culminate. And yeah, it culminated in the Holocaust of another world and the creation of a world. And that was the, originally, when I saw the mountain of suitcases, I actually thought it was a reference to the Holocaust. I didn't recognize that it was until later, that it was like the repetition, like many emissaries before him have come with the same type of suitcase. I thought it was like, you know, and I suppose that the image can do double duty. Like, narratively, you see that he's not the first emissary to come, you know, but it also has connotations of, you know, genocide and whatnot, you know, with the Jews luggage being kind of ransacked for valuables and then tossed into a heap. Actually, you know, definitely want to watch it again.
I highly recommend it. I actually can't recommend anything any more than that, because like every time I've watched it, I've and like I said, like I'm at the point now where I watched it for this podcast again, and I really felt like I could see in each moment decisions that Tippett was making, which made the whole thing a little bit recursive, because like you're first kind of experiencing like the very broad things of elements of it, and then like every time I've watched it, I've just seen more in the texture of, you know, the visuals and the
yeah,
some of the homages, like 2001 A Space Odyssey, and I think pretty explicitly Lynch a couple times, but like the Maggot Baby, the nurse and the surgeon, they're moving backwards, I believe. I think when they first enter, no, I think they're using stop motion. I don't know, but there was something that called that. But there's all these different things that pop out And it's funny. It's really fucking funny. Like, it's really hard to describe how goddamn hilarious this is. And it really only gets funnier. It only got funnier for me each time I watched it.
And it's hilarious. And on top of all of this, we haven't even mentioned that there's no dialogue. There's no dialogue in the film whatsoever, except for I had subtitles on, and only time there was any intelligible dialogue was when the second mushroom creature saw the first mushroom creature being taken away by the spider creature and said, "Oh no." That was
well,
it.
And there's actual, there is a radio, there's a radio, and then there's also, what do you call it? Morse code. When the last man, as he's called in the credits, but I've come to wonder if he is maybe connected to God, the guy who's sending, the priest lord who's sending down the emissaries.
Right.
He goes into this like bunk, like into this room with all these like all this equipment, and he's listening to various transmissions, and he's tracking the diving bell thing as it's going down to this world. And I guess I did read this online. I didn't actually verify the Morse code, but the Morse code is an SOS, and there is a voice speaking, but I wasn't able to. I didn't really listen super hard yet to see what they were saying. But there's a Morse code calling out SOS, and there's no dialogue really.
Yeah, I liked it a lot. I mean, I don't know if I have anything new to add that, you know, it would add to what's already been said about it, or, you know, either here or elsewhere. But yeah, I thought it was, I mean, excellent for pretty obvious reasons.
All right. You know, that I cannot defend at this point the fleeting sense that I have that there is, I guess there's something positive and humanist in how I've experienced it. I don't know if there's anything that's coming directly from it, because it is a bleak motherfucking movie, but it is really funny. It has, you know, a row of giants being perpetually electrocuted so that they drop gloops of shit into a big tube system that another giant head, severed head, is eating greedily, feeding tubes that then are, you know, press the goop and a bunch of hair into little slave hairball people. And if you heard that and you were like, that sounds terrible. Great. That sounds terrible. I want to say, like, I think each of us really enjoyed this movie. You really do have to give yourself permission to duck out.
Yeah, you like, probably do.
10 minutes in, you're like 15 minutes in. If it's feeling like it's not for you, then you have all the permission in the world. But really, I am just so astounded that something like this even exists, and I really deeply love it. So, huge recommend from me. Please check it out.
And just remember that if you don't watch it all the way through, you will miss out on two thralls, gigantic thralls with face masks, battling with shovels until they get electrocuted by the alchemist. And one of them has like a giant throbbing erection,
huge dick, yeah,
as it's being electrocuted. Like, yeah, you would miss that, and you don't want to miss that.
You would miss that. You would miss the second emissaries a little bit funnier, like wrestling with old kind of World War II, like motorcycle and Jeep,
yeah,
and hammering at the radio to trying to get it shut up. You know, just...
you should watch it.
A montage of scenes where like hairball slaves are being crushed and obliterated and knocked over and setting themselves on fire and somehow the editing of it makes it all hilarious.
Yeah.
Great. What are we doing next, guys?
Well, it's going to be Patrick's turn next, right? Because I used two picks in a row for the, in retrospect, rather ill-fated Q Roan Bleak House twofer.
Oh, did you?
Yeah.
Was that the deal that it's my pick?
Yeah, that was my understanding of the deal. I'm certainly happy to renege. All right, well, but, that was what I thought I agreed to.
I blanked on it, so if you have something, you can go ahead and pick it, or I'll have to chat message you guys because I totally blanked on that.
Well, we're technically a week ahead of schedule. If you want to take a week and consider, you're welcome to, or I can pick something now and we can just. I guess I could owe you guys one later on. Whichever, I'm fine either way.
Go ahead and pick something then.
Okay. That's fine. Whenever it was my next pick, I was going to pick, this is, we're a little bit behind the craze on this book, but I, have been meaning to read it. And so I was going to say Perfection by Vincenzo Latronico.
Okay. Perfection. Okay.
Awesome. Thank you, everybody, for listening to this episode, and join us next for Perfection by Vincenzo Latronico.